Welcome to the second day of the council meeting. I see we have the Blues Brothers down here this morning. John, the chairman, had a family issue to deal with this morning. He's going to be a little bit late. Before we get started, George Darcy had an announcement to make concerning the proposed rule.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to let people know that the long-awaited National Standard 1 guideline proposed rule, what we call the ACLAM rule sometimes, has gone to the Office of Federal Register, and I believe copies have been emailed to you if you have access to your email, and there will be copies made available here. The presentation will be tomorrow, but because that rule's now public or just about to be generally public, we'll be able to have a full discussion of what actually is being proposed. I just wanted to make you aware of that.
Are there any council questions for George on that? Okay, we will move right along since we have a pretty full agenda today. We will move to the 8:30 item, which is Dr. Rago and giving us an update on the GARM. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, Nan.
Yeah, thanks, Rip. Of course, now I have to form words. I haven't even had a full cup of coffee, but what I wanted to do is, before Paul gave his presentation, is just remind you that we had the GARM biological reference point meeting, and that was what we were planning to report on as requested. Since then, of course, what we've been doing is evaluating the status of individual stocks relative to the revised and new, in which case if they are new or revised, biological reference points. And so, as a heads up, I want you to know that we have some additional and new information that, in my view, at this point is still preliminary, because this is the information that, in fact, will be peer-reviewed at the August GARM meeting. But just in the intention of full disclosure and giving you a heads up, I think it's important that we provide this information to you now.
All right, good. Now there will be at least some communication, since you'll be able to see the slides. Thank you very much, Nancy and Mr. Chairman. It's my pleasure to present on behalf of the Center and the work that's been done for the groundfish assessment review, the results of the biological reference point meeting, which was held in April and through May 2nd. It reflects, an enormous amount of ongoing work and a complete revamping of the information associated with the groundfish assessment. And so I'll try to give you a little bit of background and details on that information and try to highlight some of the major points. As Nancy said, there will also be some additions which are not in your presentation material, which are indicative of the preliminary draft provisional rough estimates of the information from the stock status. The data that are presented are available or will be available on the web page, and they were distributed to people at the meeting, so it is available. Now, some people have asked, noticed that we use Roman numerals for naming GARMs, and we use Arabic numbers for the SARC, and they asked me, well, what's all that all about? Is that like in the Super Bowl? And I said, no. I says, it's like world wars, you know. So it has been an exercise. So next slide. Just give you a little bit of background on. There we go. Oh, divine intervention. It's a.
Don't worry, Paul. On the way here, a black cat went right across in front of my car, and I knew it was going to.
Did you run it over? Oh, sorry. Okay, here we go. I took the secret lock off. What's new one of the primary aspects of this assessment has been to a revision of the data, and we're looking at it in a great deal of detail, not only with respect to updating the landings data, doing revised allocation algorithms for providing stock area estimates and so forth, but also spending a lot of time on the discard estimation. And that was sort of the subject of yesterday's presentation and so forth. The other thing that's new within these reference points is that in many instances, we took a longer view, longer time series of data for the stocks as measures that are indicative of long-term potential. And it also was informative in terms of the absence of recovery after decades of lower fishing. So that was informative. In terms of the models, we looked at a suite of revised models. We've gone very intensively into each of the analytical approaches, and we've spent a lot of time on probably the fundamental challenge or the relevance of stock assessment people to this process, which are the retrospective patterns. So we've done a lot of work to try to identify the factors underlying retrospective patterns and then how to deal with them and how to provide information that's relevant to the management context. The new models, some were accepted. Many of them are used to guide the formulation of the models, and others clearly need more work. One of the other aspects of this assessment is we've reduced the number of stocks with so-called index stocks. These are also could be called model resistant stocks or stocks that they're kind of in the primordial soup of analytical methods there. So we've reduced that. So there are some advances here. Next slide. And then the biological reference points. One of the key things is there's an improved consistency between the models and the reference points. That consistency is important for estimating F-rebuild and estimating targets. There's a summary of trends in biological productivity. I'll spend a fair bit of time on that today because that is really central to the recovery of these resources and what can be taken from them as yield. And then we had a fairly extensive and important section on ecosystem considerations, and I'll summarize some of the factors there. And of course, the one of the burning issues, of course, is how much is there a good, thanks, yeah, I'll leave it on. So one of the burning issues, of course, can the system support all of these stocks at somewhere near BMSY? Are we fooling ourselves or not? So that was the purpose of that exercise. So today, I'll give you an overview of the meeting, summarize the major conclusions, emphasize the provisional nature of the results. Yesterday's word was transition. Today's word is provisional. Try to emphasize that aspect of it. I'll give you some general trends and then summarize the results by stock. This is not in your report, and there's a this is the additional estimates for 2006 and for 2006 SSBs, so forth. My tie seems to be shrinking, I think, here at this point. And then we'll have some address questions as. Okay. So what's with this addition here? First, you know, the work the PDT has suggested, the measures call for, up to reductions of up to 75%. Obviously, those are extraordinarily severe. Those are conditioned on the expected behavior of or the expected requirements for white hake. On Friday, we're asked to say just okay, put together the preliminary values of stock status and make a comparison with respect to the reference points. So that was the weekend work, and then took a look at that. And the on Monday morning, it was clear that a few things needed to be discussed. And so what we will be presenting are the estimates for for 2006 and biomass estimates for 2006 as well. First caveat is that these estimates were not part of the GARM BRP meeting. You know, the focus there was on reference points, not on the estimates of contemporary stock status. Second, the measures are provisional, preliminary. I ran out of words that expressing uncertainty there, but they're also not peer reviewed, and they're provided simply as a way of gauging the general trends. Third, the F values necessary for rebuilding have not been computed. Just because we're overfishing or not overfishing with respect to the new reference points does not mean that the measures necessary for F rebuilding are immediately clear. That is, you know, there may be a direction, but it's not exact. And then finally, the panel recommended modifications of several assessments for August, so those need to be incorporated. So next slide. Okay, now we resume normal broadcast here. This is the information you have in your booklet there. The reviewers were we had a very very good. Set of panels. Vivian Haste, formerly of DFO, and was provided through the Center for Independent Experts. Michael Bell, who was formerly with the Center for Environment, Fisheries, and Aquaculture Science, known as CEFAS, was present. Stuart Reeves, who's currently employed by in the United Kingdom, was also there. Grant Thompson, we were fortunate. Grant was one of the primary people that have been sort of instrumental in developing biological reference points for stocks on a national level and sort of writing a lot of the National Standard 1 guidelines and so forth. And then Stratus Gavaris, I'm not sure many of you know through the interactions with the TRAC, was also one of our reviewers. A person who was not our reviewer but made an extraordinary amount of contributions, and I'm quoting from the report here, you know, the panel would also like to acknowledge the valuable contributions to the meeting made by all participants, particularly that of Doug Butterworth, who attended on behalf of the fishing industry. So I think it was, you know, a very insightful set of comments that Doug has provided, and we've had a lot of discussions offline, I think. Valuable and insightful kinds of contributions that Doug has made to this process. So the terms of reference for this meeting or any meeting are sort of central to how it's conducted. And, of course, the first thing is the an attempt to look at the retrospective patterns and how do we specify the initial conditions for forecasting. Forecasting is in the sense of estimating catches for 2009 and also the rebuilding strategies. We had a section on looking at stock productivity, which is looking at the basic biology of the animals and saying what's going on there. Ecosystem approaches were applied. There's five different approaches. They're summarized. We looked at the biological reference points by each stock. That's the meat of this presentation. And then we did a little bit of analysis on forecasting tools that we've used for in the past. So next slide. So the general aspect of the trends in system productivity, there were a number of changes in average weight, and the consequence of this is that it shifts the partial recruitment pattern. A partial recruitment pattern is the force of mortality that's applied to each age group in the population. That is, if you're selecting, you know, all of the age 4-year-old animals are fully vulnerable to the gear and to the fishing effort, you may have only half the 3-year-olds available, and then maybe 10% of the 2-year-olds. So that pattern of age-specific mortality rate is what is in the jargon is called the partial recruitment pattern, the selectivity pattern. Now, as the fish grow more slowly, that means that the force of mortality is shifted to older ages because that usually selectivity is a size-based phenomena. In addition, one of the other factors that shifts the partial recruitment pattern is gear. So you go to a larger mesh, you select larger and older animals. If they're growing slowly, they can be much older. So that's a very important and kind of central theme in terms of interpreting what's going on here. there are many instances of lower estimates of maximum sustainable yields, indicative that the system appears to be less productive in the last decade. There are generally lower biological reference points, and there was a general consistency between the estimated biological reference points and the measures of system productivity, but more work was suggested. To give you an idea or crystallize some of it, next slide. Thanks. This is average meat weight or mean weights for witch flounder, showing trends over time, basically looking from about 1982 to 2006. And as you can see, the average 8-year-old fish in the early 90s is now the same size as an 8-year-old fish. The 7-year-old fish is approaching the 6-year-old fish size, and so forth there. So the age-specific trends are down, and in this case, important but not dramatic. In the next slide, there's the average weights for George's Bank haddock, and each of the lines represents smooth through the data, but essentially you can see that the oldest fish in the 70s and 80s is about half the size it was in the present time or so forth. So it's very dramatic and striking, and tends to be a progressive decrease in average weights as the older fish. So basically, they're lean and mean, I guess. And I think this is a direct tie-in with respect to fishermen observations. These patterns are consistent, not only in the survey data survey data and so forth, but also in those fishery samples from observers and the fishery samples from the port agents. So there's quite a big thing. The other one, these are I think you may be able to see. If you got a color copy, you can see them in your things. They don't show up very well for the audience, and I apologize there. But the material will be available. But the idea is to kind of do a consumer report type of analysis. So if you're used to deciding whether you want to buy a Lexus or a Yugo, you can usually see more black on the latter than on the former, and can give you some idea of what's important. These are done on a quintile basis. That is, you look at it the lowest 20%, the 20 to 40%, the 40 to 60. The same way that Consumer Reports sort of gauges product quality. This is trying to get a snapshot across multiple species and areas, and those three blocks correspond to the Gulf of Maine, to George's Bank, and into southern New England. What is clear, even with or without glasses, is that there are more black dots in the last decade and a half in the Gulf of Maine area there. Next slide. George's Bank haddock. Here you're seeing in graphical form what's observed on the in the previous slide with age specific changes. But again, seeing a lot of black smaller average size values there. And now, Georgia's Bank Haddock has been addressed in terms of a density effect, and what appears to be going on is sort of a simultaneous effect, not only of higher density associated with the 2003 year class and some of the earlier ones, as well as a general environmental effect. One of the pieces of evidence that suggests that it's not only just density is that when you look at the next slide, which is the Gulf of Maine haddock, you have a little bit less data, but you see the same general pattern. The Gulf of Maine haddock are also quite small average size, you know, so reflecting system changes not only on Georgia's but on in the Gulf of Maine. And then the that little black strip that looks this diagonal strip on the side in the upper left-hand corner there, those are reflective of the 63 year class of things. So you can really kind of, it really pops out if you're interested in this kind of stuff in terms of trying to track the effect of those cohorts. So that one apparently was our interpretation is that was mainly a density effect. In this one, we're seeing partially a density effect, but also a broad scale change. Next slide. This is for redfish. This is obviously a deep water Gulf of Maine thing. The main point, take home message here, is that we're looking at a lot of blacks dots on the in the last decade in terms of average size of those cohorts. Next slide. And pollock is interesting as well. So there's a change in the average sizes that's consistent beginning about 1994. That's an important time period with respect to some of the changes that are in these models. So next slide. Thanks. There we go. So basic trends there. You know, there's trends in average in length and weight of the 14 stocks examined. You know, 12 of them were decreasing. There's delayed maturation. That is, the animals that formerly matured at age 3 are now delaying to 4, et cetera. So in examination of those trends, we found 11 were increasing in recent years. So the spawning stock biomass is being affected. Some global trends. NAO is North Atlantic Oscillation, I can't remember what the Northwest GS is. Yeah, it's not an agency. North Wall of the Gulf Stream. Sorry. Thank you. You know, and there are additional knowledge, but this is very preliminary in terms of, you know, associations and patterns, and of course, you know, there's always the correlation does not imply causality kind of constraint on this, but you know, there are some general trends that do appear to be consistent, and more importantly for the stock assessment, irrespective of the causes of these things, it's important that the consequences of these factors, whatever they might be, are incorporated into the assessments, and that is kind of a central premise in the determination of the biological reference points as well as the fishing mortalities necessary to achieve those reference points. Next slide. Okay, there's a lot of words here, you can read them faster than I can speak them, and that may be a preferable option for you as well. But there's a generally a smaller size at age, delayed maturity at age, and decreased survival of recruits are all measures of reduced productivity, and the consequences are them. Are to the lower, generally lower biomass reference points. It implies slower rebuilding rates. They're generally lower extractions or total landings and discards during the thing. And oftentimes they can imply increases in discarding. And this council has addressed some of those issues most recently with the Georges Bank haddock and size limits and so forth. These are very important for fisheries management and particularly It's important, you know, when these changes or trends in biological productivity are unrecognized or masked by other factors, the assessment results will result in overestimates of allowable landings, can overestimate the spawning stock potential, and lead to overly optimistic predictions of stock recovery. And then finally, if you fail to curtail the catches during periods like this, you can further reduce stock size and curtail nascent recoveries. So in the context of if the average size of the fish has decreased by 20%, you're monitoring this or on a quota basis, you are by definition going to be taking 20% more individuals out of the population for the same amount of total quota. The consequence of that is the fishing mortality, which is applied to each of the age classes, is going to be higher. So even though the targets have been achieved, the decrease in average weight will offset or reduce the effectiveness of those quotas because the mortality will be higher. So next slide, thanks. Ecosystem considerations. There were five different approaches. Bill Overholtz was instrumental in doing a lot of this work, as well as Jason Link and Mike Fogarty. But there were a number of tacks that were taken. There were cross-system comparisons on a worldwide basis. They looked at overall energy budget for the system. They applied some aggregated surplus production models, sort of lumped models to look at the consequences of sort of an aggregate mix of species. There were some simulation models for looking at interactions, and then there were some analyses of fishery production potential. The panel was, commended the group on its efforts, and that this was providing, some valuable evidence and a cross check for the system levels there. The next slide shows the. Some general conclusions from the ecosystem, and anything that's in quotations in your presentation is taken from the draft report. But not all of the information is consistent. But generally they have the same trend. One of the important factors is that the in order for this to proceed. Sort of at the same time as the biological reference points, they were working on the basis of the old reference points. The new reference points were not in hand, so some of the conclusions from the thing are reflective of the earlier estimates from GARM 1. There were some suggestions for research on that. And the next slide will show the something else here. Okay. So, next slide, please. Thanks. Yeah. The key questions, or some of the key questions, are these current patterns evidence of long-term trends? You know, is this just a transient component or what? But there, we did focus on the contemporary growth rates in view of the short rebuilding time for most of the species, and that there was some major changes in the partial recruitment between, and so those differences make comparisons difficult. Remember, when we talk about fishing mortality, we're talking about a scalar quantity that is actually a vector. So that's probably clear as mud, but it just means that we're not looking at a single value. The force of mortality that's being applied to these resources is applied to the oldest age classes, but then it's applied differentially to those at younger ages. So, next slide, thanks. So, the biological reference points, some key conclusions. We reduced the number of assessments based on index methods. We increased the number based on the analytical models, and we used long-term time series going back into the early part of this the previous century for redfish and halibut. So, there are a number of technical issues that the panel recommend. Most formerly was they spent a lot of time on whether we should use means or medians as measures of central tendency. That is, what best describes the bulk of the data. There was a fair amount of discussion on that, and the panel agreed with the use of the medians, which has been the operating definition that the council's been using. But they did suggest that we estimate the means as well as the medians for that. Now, for the most part, that's it will not make a great deal of difference, but it is an important part. This is a form of stock assessment humor. Here it says, most assessments did not display compelling evidence of a particular functional form, that is, a Ricker versus a Beverton and Holt or anything, which is probably true on almost all of our stock assessments. And we use a non-parametric analysis for the stock recruitment relationship, which is similar to what was used in the previous definitions. So in the absence of a strong evidence of overcompensation, we use a thing. So this is a new slide, and it's just a kind of a cartoon to give you an idea of how to get into these slides. So there's a stock area map. There's a picture of the fish so that I know what it looks like and which end of the fish goes forward and so forth. But there's also estimates of the BMSY, the FMSY, and the maximum sustainable yield. The table consists of the current values as well as the revised values. And in underneath each of the values. Now, you don't have those, so they're, you can write those in if you want along the way, or the values will be available however you want to distribute them. So if you leave it on, say just one more second, thanks. So each of those are in red, and then in brackets there, you have the provisional. Again, these are all preliminary. They're indicative, but again, subject to change. Thank you. Sorry. And this is in the caveats. Most of the stocks are showing reductions in productivity. The estimates of fishing mortality rate necessary for rebuilding have not been done. Not even in the preliminary information in the working papers. The lower target bias masses do not necessarily mean that there's lower rates of F for rebuilding. Thank you. Yeah, next one. Okay. Georges Bank Cod. The number, the A on that is that refers to the chapter headings within the SARC or in the GARM report. There, they're in the order that God intended them to be. That's A is for Georges Bank Cod, B is for Georges Bank Haddock, C is for Georges Bank Yellowtail, etc. I'll go through them on a species basis. The current estimate for BMSY is about 216,000. That is reduced based on the revised deformation to 143,000. Current stock size estimate is about 12%, I think, roughly of that number, maybe 20. And that's about 12. Excuse me. The fishing mortality rates. The FMSY has gone up. Remember, that is a consequence of the slower growth and the shift in the selectivity pattern to larger and older animals. It also is probably reflective of the changes in the selection pattern of the gear going to the 6.5-inch mesh and much of the fishery. So it means that the fishing mortality on the oldest can be increased, but it doesn't mean that you're going to take more out of the resource. It just means that the fishing mortality on that fraction of the resource which is selected is going to be can be a little bit higher. The current estimate, again with the wiggle lines in there, this is 0.31. The MSY value drops from 35,000 to 30,000. Next slide, thanks. Gulf of Maine cod, just to keep the symmetry here, we had a fair amount of discussion on Gulf of Maine cod. There was a lot of input from Doug Butterworth and alternative models that were compared. And I think that, you know, we had a very healthy debate on this, not only at the meeting, but subsequent to the meeting and so forth. Estimated BMSY level drops, from 82 to 71,000 metric tons. The FMSY does not change significantly, and the current fishing mortality rate on that is still a little bit high. Again, this is for 2006. It does not reflect 2007 data. So forth. We had extensive discussions on the concept of what might be called a dome-shaped partial recruitment pattern. That is, that older fish become less vulnerable to the gear and capture a lower fishing mortality rate, either through unavailability to the gear in some way, basically leave it at that. There are a variety of mechanisms. But one of the things that was used as an important aspect and ties back into cooperative work done with the fishing industry, the results of the tagging studies from SMAS, GMRI, and those sponsored in the consortium and so forth, and I apologize if I've left anybody off that may have sponsored or conducted those studies, but they were kind of instrumental in terms of analyzing this dome-shaped partial recruitment pattern and provide a lot of insight. So just to acknowledge that component there. The next on there. Georges Bank Haddock. Based on these estimates, the estimate in 2000, it's the productivity drops by about 100,000 metric tons. The current value is quite a bit higher than that. This is not a completely uncommon kind of phenomena. We see this in herring and maybe to a lesser extent mackerel in terms of where their current stock status is. And, of course, this is driven in large part by the measures from the the 2003 year class and so forth. Overfishing is not occurring, but the long-term MSY on this, given, you can't bank on a 2003 year class occurring with any great regularity. So that's the, those are the provisional estimates there. Next slide, thanks. The Gulf of Maine haddock. This one was a transition from an index-based assessment to an age-based assessment. You can see the numbers in the two columns are not comparable with respect to the fishing mortality rates, primarily because one is based on a catch per unit index. So it's just basically what's the total removals divided by the average survey index. But the other one does have some currency that's comparable, and it's at about 0.45. That is indicative of that shift again. Remember, it's a shift towards the capture of older animals. The fact that they're growing slower is also a factor, and it's also a large mesh. But the MSY from this resource is suggested that it's about 1,400 metric tons. And then, of course, the other factor was incorporated is that there's increasing uncertainty in the estimates of removals, because we have an increasing fraction through recreational landings. So next slide, thanks. Georges Bank Yellowtail, biomass estimates drop from 58 to 46,000. Current estimates are on the order of about 5,000 metric tons. The FMSY does not change, but the current estimates are about three times higher than the target. The MSY drops from 13,000 to 10,000. Next slide. Gulf of Maine. Is everybody getting, everybody writing that stuff down? Is it going too fast? Okay. Nobody wants it. Okay. Okay. The Gulf of Maine yellowtail, another cause for concern, slower growth, lower by a third in terms of biomass. FMSY increases slightly, again, slower growth, but we're, even at that, we're considerably above that in terms of fishing mortality rates. The MSY drops to about 2,000. Next slide, thanks. Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic yellowtail. Revised estimates are quite a bit lower. The stock size is on the order of 2,000 metric tons. I don't think any great surprises, but the fishing mortality again shows a what is a developing pattern of Fs being about 2 to 3 times higher. There's also a about a halving of the estimated MSY from this resource. Obviously, the Southern New England area and stocks there, and we'll look at winter flounder and ocean pout. They're at extraordinarily low levels. Next slide, thanks. Which flounder, which I showed you the graph in terms of average weights. Those BMSY levels have dropped to about 40% of what they were. We're about halfway there. Fishing mortality rate is current is on the order of about, it's overfishing is not occurring. And the MSY estimates are again halved there. So it's a kind of indicative of, if you will, a deep water Gulf of Maine issue. Okay, next slide. American Place was not updated. The data for this species became available on Sunday morning before the GARM was to start, so it wasn't able to get that one updated. The information based on just the changes in average weights, basically using the old models, just updating them, suggest going from 29,000 to 20,000 metric tons in terms of BMSY, and roughly about 4,300 metric tons in terms of MSY levels. This is one that will be updated quite extensively as a result of the meeting, so to be determined. Next slide. Gulf of Maine winter flounder. Biological reference points are have reduced slightly for this. The current stock size is probably about 20% of that revised value. FMSY is reduced on this resource, but the fishing mortality is probably twice as high. Next slide. Thank you. Georges Bank winter flounder. The BMSY level is gone up. Some of this may be due to the incorporation of additional information, which was previously, previously it was a surplus production model. It's been revised, and there's an age-based production model or age-based VPA, and that has increased. The estimate of BMSY, we're at about one-third of the rebuilt status. Fishing mortality is about on target, though, and the FMSY is slightly higher. Next slide, please. Okay, Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic winter flounder, the reference point increases slightly. FMSY declines and the MSY stays about the same. If there's a general take-home message, we have that again. This consistent pattern of very high rates of fishing mortality on that on these on the inshore. White hake. There's quite a dramatic set of changes in this assessment. And the BMSY estimates go from about 14,000 to 56,000. And part of the reason for that is that the previous assessment used only fish greater than 60 centimeters. The reason for that was that there were sort of unresolvable unresolvable problems at that time with respect to landings information where red hake and white hake were not uniquely identified. And so, you know, we think we've handled most of that, and so that we now have estimates of removal that fully incorporate, you know, all of the landings from the white hake. It's one more second on that one. Thanks. How am I doing on time? Should I be pulling the plug? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Okay. Okay. This one, the MSY is slightly higher, and but the big change here, of course, is that FMSY and current levels are consistent with each other. Now this is a sea change difference from what was expected under the projections and the scheduled changes. So that's the big part of this. So thanks. Next slide. Yes, I'm sure. Thank you. I think I'm sure. Pollock is an index-based assessment. It's a shared resource with Canada and going to be subject to an evaluation through the TRAC. But the estimated change in the BMSY levels was based on a set of arguments that suggested that the previous estimate of 3 kilos per tow in our survey was probably too high, and it really should be on the order of 2 kilos per tow. That was the assessment panel and so forth, and everyone agreed that that was the appropriate estimate there. So, and then I apologize, I forgot to add the value in there for the F estimate in 2006. Let's see if I. Oh, it's about 5.0. So it's less than FMSY. Okay, next slide. Redfish. Again, not a great deal of change. That's 236,000. That zero down below doesn't mean anything. It's just a formatting issue there. The biological reference point did not change. Nor did the estimate of FMSY or MSY for that matter. The current stock size suggests that it's fairly close to the 239,000. And one of the major sources of uncertainty in a lot of these things, in the same way that you know, when you don't have much fishing going on, you get very low rates, and it's hard to tell. Get a good estimate of stock size because you're not seeing any changes, but we are seeing, you know, quite dramatic increases in survey estimates there. Ocean pout, we're at about 10% of the BMSY. It's an index-based stock. The fishing mortality rate is below the catch index level, and so there's not a whole lot of change on this, and certainly no good news on the ocean pout. It's a small resource. Next slide, thank you. Northern window pane, one of the index stocks again. It's primarily most of its removals right now are discards and bait, I guess. These are expressed in terms of survey units, about a key average of about a kilo per tow, in survey terms. The FMSY is about the same. I mean, the small stock, low productivity suggests on the order of about 1,000 metric tons. Next slide for southern window pane, even smaller stock. Below BMSY, but still at fairly low levels. So I'll move on from that. Thanks. Next slide. Thanks. Okay, we did take a look at the halibut, and benefited not only from taking a longer perspective, but Doug Butterworth played a big role in terms of guiding some of the work on this, and similarly to work on other stocks around the world. And next slide has the changes. Now these are some fairly big changes, and I think you have to wait for the final report to get all the details here. But I guess the bottom line there is a lot more work is necessary. Particularly the natural mortality rates are probably too low that are used in these models. So this whole thing could change quite dramatically. The fishing mortality rates are very low, but halibut have a rather unfortunate shape with respect to a trawl, and have been decimated. You can see from that previous slide, just back up for a second, that the train left the station on halibut early in the 19th or the 20th century. So in terms of changes, so next slide, thanks. And then one of the things that I don't think this one is in the, it's not in the slide. Yeah, no, this was just I was just trying to do some quick summary information here. The current total MSY values based on the GARM-1 results are about 200,000 metric tons of MSY. That the new revisions suggest on the order of about 150,000 metric tons. So there's about a 21% reduction in overall sustainable yield from the ecosystems that support fisheries in the groundfish multi-species plan. The ecosystem analysis suggested that the MSY was about 70% of that 197. So, we're sort of in the ballpark there between the 155 and 138,000 metric tons in terms of, they're both the basically two independent lines of evidence in terms of analysis. So next slide, please. And then wanted to highlight and emphasize the importance of the work that remains to be done in August. First one being that all of the information for the 2007 landings and discard data are going to be incorporated into this thing. Again, the reason that there's those delays, there's about a 6-month lag time between the information that's provided and when it's available in fully audited form. There's also the usual VTRs come in right around the end of April prior to the fishing, start of the fishing year. A lot of information comes in. There's a lot of lags in the provision of information. That is kind of a central message here. The stock assessment of model formulations and peer review of them will be kind of the key aspect of the assessment. Then those estimates that are in brackets in these presentations and what I've presented today are subject to change. Those formulations are likely to be important. We'll get the estimated biomass and F estimates. There will also be some finalized the biological reference points. Those are subject to some additional revisions, but not expected to change significantly. The estimates of rebuilding fishing mortality rates will be done as a result of those updated assessments, and so they'll be that remains to be seen. I think the direction is generally clear. The magnitude is not, and so that's the important take home. And then finally, Okay. The thanks. The 2009 scenario. You know, there'll be estimates of catches for 2009, and the reason for this is to kind of jumpstart the work of the PDTs, so that the projection of methodology, the initial conditions, the and so forth will all be worked out, and they'll be ready to roll with their work. So thank you again. I know it was not the bearer of good news on a lot of this stuff, but it was, thank you for your time. The rest of it's just junk.
Thank you.
It's blurred. It may have started at the beginning.
Chris? Thank you for that report, and I am sure that when we get to questions here, there's going to be quite a few of them for you. But Tom?
Yeah, I was actually going to wait, but Chris chased me up here, so I'll ask it right now anyway. The last slide, what's left to do in August, this seems to imply the last two bullets that defining the revised rebuilding Fs and estimating catches for 2009 will be done at the GARM. And I thought we were always operating under the assumption that those would be done by the PDT working with the council after the GARM. Now, I don't know if there's been a decision made at the NRCC to revise that or what.
I can tell you my rationale or the rationale I thought was important and for that or the development of the estimates of not only the F rebuild but also the estimated catches under the current rates and require setting up some models and so forth. The idea is that it would give at least the first cut of what those numbers would be if the F rebuild policy was implemented. It is in no way trying to trump the prerogative of the council to choose other ones. It was just simply a way of facilitating the work of the plan development team so that all of the information necessary to generate those numbers would be in place and so forth. It would not be a forecasting kind of exercise. It's just simply, if the fishing mortality rate at the current status quo Fs was to continue, here's what it'd be, what it might be under an FMSY policy and what it would be under a rebuild policy necessary to achieve a specific target.
Questions from council members? Jim.
I don't know if this is of Paul or not, but on some of these stocks, at what point do we have to reset the rebuilding timelines? In other words, if you find out you can't rebuild in 10 years in the absence of fishing, do you have to reset to add another generation? Because if I look at some of the yellowtails or some of the flounder stocks, it would seem to me that even if you didn't fish, you may not be able to get where you need to be in 10 years. And does that cause a reset in our rebuilding timelines?
That's definitely one that I can't answer.
Nancy?
Well, your interpretation of the information is absolutely correct. But as far as resetting the timeline, as far as the rebuilding period is concerned, obviously that's not directed to the Science Center. I mean, our job is to provide the advice. And obviously, our intention here was to give people a heads up as soon as we saw what was happening relative to these stocks to provide that information to you. So I think that that question is more appropriate, quite frankly, for George and the regional office.
The answer is, frankly, we don't know. There is no provision in the Act nor in the guidelines that addresses that situation. And I don't think, although the question's come up before, I don't think there's ever been a situation where it's actually been addressed. You're right. I mean, this is very sobering information here, and we just got it. So we're considering what exactly it does mean and what the options may be. We briefed the senior leadership of the agency last night on this because this was a surprise to them as well. Pat Kirkle doesn't know it yet. She's at an international meeting, and we couldn't reach her. So we're going to have to look at this, and certainly at the final numbers. These are preliminary, but we thought it was important to give these to you and the public today to give an indication of the magnitude of the problem that we're looking at and the direction, which is, I think, different than we thought we were going.
A follow-up question will be, will we be able to glean from the information we get from your final report whether we can rebuild in 10 years or not? Will we be able to get that out of there?
Yeah, that will be. I mean, if it's possible, then you'll have an F that will be commensurate with that rebuilding target. If it's not, the F will be zero, and you'll have that would be the determination as to whether you do it. So, but that will be a policy decision. Thank you,
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I appreciate the heads up. I'm not sure how to react to this information. It's not really too upsetting yet, because after all, the emphasis on, Paul emphasized the fact that, you know, the numbers regarding where we stand right now in 2006 for biomass and F values are provisional, preliminary, uncertain, subject to change, and not peer reviewed. You emphasized that, and I appreciated that because, as always, you're quite frank. So the numbers don't startle me yet, because of all of these qualifiers. And I'm going to now go with the advice provided by Paul and company, and that is the direction is clear, but the magnitude is not. So I'm going to assume, for now anyways, because I wasn't at the biological reference point meeting, if I had known it was going to be a mini-GARM, I would have made sure I was there, but I had other commitments. Anyways, I'm going to assume that, for example, on page 15 of the handout, where we look at southern New England, mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder, just as an example, I'm going to assume that clearly our fishing mortality, the trend is higher than where we want to be relative to our reference point. But I don't know how high above. Right now, you had it as 0.80. versus 0.26 as the revised FMSY value. I can't relate to the 0.80, again, because it's provisional, preliminary, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just going to assume that the F is too high, and I'm going to have to wait until we get to the GARM and we go through the detailed, very well-done work by the GARM scientists and the peer review to enable us to determine where we stand. In addition, as you emphasized, this is through 2006, so I don't know the impacts of Framework 42. I know landings were down, way down for many of the species, many of these stocks. I'm assuming that one of the reasons why landings were way down is the severity of our management measures through Framework 42. So perhaps the F values that will be provided to us through the GARM relative to what is assumed to be the F in 2007, will give us some additional information that, of course, will then guide us as to what we need to do in the next amendment. So correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but it's what I just said. Is it a fair assessment of the situation relative to, for example, how we should react to 0.80 for southern New England, mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder?
Basically that the information suggests that in 2006 the estimate was well above the reference point. As you noted, if the landings in 2007 are low enough, they may be down, but are they low enough to create or induce an even lower estimate, 0.5, then that would be the value you would use as a basis for comparison. I think it's unlikely that that resource is overfishing is not occur. I think it's likely that overfishing is occurring. So.
I don't disagree with you. I'm still trying to figure out how to react to this information,
right,
new numbers, because it is a bit of a unexpected turn of events. That is, we're sitting here today getting these numbers. Thank you for them. Don't get me wrong. We appreciate the fact that you're giving us the heads up, but I'm going to have to chew on this for a while. Now, I have another question. Biological reference points. Appreciate the fact that we have individual numbers relative to the reference points for these different stocks. I was under the impression, for a long time, that the group doing the work on the biological reference point revision wasn't going to be able to come up with a single estimate, that we would end up with a range. That was the expectation. Can you clarify or explain what happened? How was the group able to actually get away from a range and give us a specific reference point?
Thanks. That issue came up fairly extensively throughout the meeting, and there was an instance. It was sort of a general consensus that if we were going forward with a particular model formulation, that in turn led to a set of recruitment estimates and partial recruitment values for a particular estimate, that that was probably a better way to go than to postulate two models, one of which would be sort of preferred, and the other one that might be alternate or subordinate. So most instances, the panel sort of felt that a particular configuration that led to a single estimate was sort of the preferred option. And initially, you're right, we were thinking that we would never get make enough progress to define things sufficiently for a single value, and I think it was kind of a collective effort. We were able to sort of get those numbers, but I suspect that could change if there's sort of a stalemate with respect to a particular model formulation that leads to here's two equally valid states of nature. It'd be somewhere in between there.
Okay, so it wasn't a simple splitting the difference.
No, it was not.
But the peer review knew we needed a single point, so they came up with a point
because we
want it.
Right,
here it
right.
is, guys. You got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Regarding the productivity estimates that are, of course, quite giving us good reason to be quite concerned about the future of the groundfish fishery and other fisheries in the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank. Was there any Canadian input in the discussions relative to the productivity of these resources? Any disagreement with the Canadians as to the findings relative to this productivity in the Northeast?
No, in fact, I think there was a great deal of consistency with those determinations. We did have representatives from DFO present, not only on the panel through Stratus Gavaris, but also in the audience with Lou Van Eckhout, who does Georges Bank Haddock, and then Kristen Larson was also present there. So there was a I may have her last name wrong, excuse me. But anyhow, it's we did have a representation there. And I think these results, especially for the shared resources, are consistent with what we see in the track determinations there. I mean, the track has been emphasizing that for Eastern Georgia's Bank Haddock, for example, quite extensively. So,
Paul, I have you next. I just wanted to ask one sort of general question as a follow-up on Dr. Pierce's. On the work that we've been doing on Amendment 16, I guess, is it fair to say we have felt that White Hake was sort of driving the bus up until today, and right now, looking at these numbers, the trend is that the flatfish are going to be driving the bus. Is that a fair overall assessment?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, that was the my read on it as well, is that the yellowtail and winter flounder resources are really the primary determinants there. That the other flatfish are showing the decreases in productivity, but in terms of contemporary rates of fishing mortality being sort of very high, that's really the where most of the problem appears to be. Thank you.
Okay. Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Paul. One of the things I wanted to ask a specific question about was the Gulf of Maine winter flounder, because that's a stock that in the previous GARM was not overfished, and overfishing is not occurring. And I also noticed that the change in FMSY was probably the most significant decrease of any of the stocks. And I see a little note down there, comparative models, VPA versus scale. Are we using different models between the last assessment and this? And do you have any, and I also noticed that F, the 2006 F, is again significantly higher than what we'd had at the last assessment. So is there any background or follow-up, that more details you can provide on why that occurred?
Okay. The Gulf of Maine, yes, that was up. Thank you. Step ahead of me there. It's not easy, not hard to do. So anyhow, yeah, the magnitude of the BMSY estimate there, I guess going from 41 to 36, I'm not sure if I no, I mean, I don't know if we have larger ones than that. Is that what your point is, or is it on the
FMSY?
That is. I guess I'm not entirely clear on that one in terms of what the change, but it is. You're right. It's a reverse of the previous value. There were multiple models used for this. This is an extraordinarily problematic resource to assess. There's a scarcity of high quality age-based data that sort of in the middle of this in the middle of the important period for assessing this resource. So that's one aspect of it, as a way of addressing that scarcity of age-based data. The scale model is a length-based estimator, which uses it's the one that was used for the monkfish assessment most recently. So that's sort of its background and genesis there. So I can't tell you off the top of my head the reason for the change in the and the FMSY level, but I can get back to you on that. As they say in the government, I get back to you on that. So, thanks.
Mark.
First one, maybe a simple question. Where did the age 8 and older pollock go in 1991? That's a funny pattern. They just seem to drop off the face of the earth.
Yeah, that question came up at the panel, it was the short answer was they are what they are. That was what's in the database. We're still having to take a look at that because that is a striking result there. And to see in many instances we see that progressive loss of the older animals in the population. They just don't show up in the sampling. This one was quite striking. So I really can't answer that one, and I have to put it into that other category of I'll follow up with it on later. So thanks, Mark.
Well, I have a follow up. That was the quick one.
Yeah, all right. I know that. the hard one's coming, eh?
No, it's not so much a hard one. I'm a little more concerned than Dr. Pierce was. The overall signal, I think, is high mortality rates relative to reference points and considerable amount of biomass rebuilding that needs to be done. And I recognize that those, as Dave does it, they're uncertain, subject to change. But one thing that strikes me that I'm hearing you say that's probably not going to change is this striking signal, consistent signal of loss of system productivity. And that seems that may hobble and cripple any ability to rebuild these fish stocks. These are critical fish stocks in the near-term future. And at the same time I'm listening to you, I'm reading this paper in the Canadian Journal about fishing enhances the climatic sensitivity of marine fishes. Just came out, and this is in the Pacific Northwest, which is happening out there. I'm wondering what the current thinking is at the center on the balance between an environmentally driven loss of productivity versus the more insidious effects of fishing, removing out your larger, most productive units and reductions in spatial extent of the fish populations and that sort of thing. And where is the thinking on that at this time?
Okay. That's an excellent question. The changes that are induced by sort of the long-term selective pattern of fishing, that is the removal of the larger animals, subsequent remove of that genetic component of the resource is certainly one that is there's evidence that's occurring. I mean, evidence in smaller controlled populations where you can actually measure that for these resources. And one of the things that is clear that the rate at which those changes have occurred are not consistent with generally known patterns of heritability for traits. Usually in heritability patterns for populations where they do have control on, say, like rainbow trout in a hatchery, where you can do extensive manipulations, the heritability per generation is on the order of 0.2. In order to see that for something like cod, you'd have to have those kinds of changes occurring over periods of decades rather than years. So that's sort of the sentiment in terms of whether or not there's a environmental signal that's inducing those changes as opposed to the longer term genetic one. And I guess in part there's a pragmatic consideration that says we don't understand or don't completely have the causal mechanisms in place, but the reality of those suggests that they're not likely to change rapidly in the other direction, so that rebuilding targets are conditioned on primarily the most recent information in terms of average weights, the most recent information in terms of maturity, the most recent information in terms of partial recruitment or selection patterns by the fishery. The longer-term implications for recruitment, again, we're conditioned on looking at productivity that is associated in many cases with larger stock sizes. So, but we explicitly want to avoid sort of a mismatch between establishing a target that is long-term and perhaps ethereal, that, you know, maybe based on a return to average weights or conditions that we're not seeing currently. Particularly, that's particularly important in terms of the short term, you know, the implications for rebuilding in a date certain format. And I think your last question about the recent paper in Canadian Journal and interactions between productivity and fishing mortality, I think in this context we're looking at it again in a sort of pragmatic context, and we'll write the long-term papers after we get through the Amendment 16, I think. So, thanks.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for a difficult presentation. I'm very concerned about the magnitude of where we have to go and for the implications of all the work that the industry, the Groundfish Committee, and the Council has done on Amendment 16 to date. You've partially, actually, you did answer one of my questions in your answer to Rip, but could you go to the Whitehake slide, please? Yeah, could you explain the bracketed 15,000 under the revised? I missed that during your presentation. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, the 15,000 metric tons is related to a characterizing the size of the resource across all age groups, all size groups. Previously, this one was defined in terms of animals above 60 centimeters. So, and clearly that's not a tenable assumption given the average size of whitehake that are in the landings now, and the previous problems of misidentification, in terms of information in the database, that's been sorted out. So, the revised estimate incorporates, all the full size range of the stock. So, thanks, Terry.
Thanks, Paul.
Jim.
Yeah, my question was on, and I'm just going to use haddock for an example, in that, well, first of all, it wasn't too long ago the MSY on haddock was over 100,000 tons. I mean, now we're down to 35. That's a big, big swing. But I'm wondering about our management strategy. In general, our strategy has been to, what I hear you saying is that mortality is too high on the older fish that we have in our stocks. And our management strategy has been to utilize mesh and minimum fish sizes to try to catch bigger fish and let smaller fish go. Would it not be better to try to take more of a cross section of the stock and allow more of the older fish to remain in the resource?
Yeah, I may have given the wrong impression on saying the fishing mortality on the older animals is too high. When we make these comparisons, we are looking at the fishing mortality rate on the oldest animal, the fully recruited animals, and what is specified under the biological reference point. In this case, for George's Bank haddock, as an example here, the FMSY that occurs on that is 0.34. The estimate for 2006 is 0.2. That means that we are not fishing too hard on the older animals. The intent of my statement was that as you delay fishing mortality to larger and older animals, that the resource or the fishing mortality rate that's applied to that can be higher, because you're taking them a greater fraction of the older animals after they've accumulated the weight and so forth. So it's simply saying that if the protective measures are in place, such as size limits and mesh size, that you can, in fact, fish harder after you've waited for them for a period of time. So thanks for the clarification. I hope it so.
Dave Gatham.
Yeah. Paul, one of the questions I have is basically if with these stocks that have gone from index or surplus production models to age-structured models, have there been any other changes in the life history aspects? In other words, has natural mortality changed for any of these like they did for monkfish? Or it's awful hard to assess these new numbers when the model changes at the same time because you don't really know where to go.
In general, the natural mortality rates have not changed for these assessments. There's a long technical argument as to how we estimated most of these parameters, and I can get into that in a minute. But to that specific point with respect to natural mortality, the only stock where it was addressed in a lot of detail was for halibut, and there Doug Butterworth suggested that our current estimates of 0.04 or 0.05 or what were not consistent with an animal that only lives at most 50 years, and he was suggesting that an increase in that natural mortality rate would be an appropriate change in the model, and that was one of the recommendations for the assessment. And that, again, that was just to highlight that particular point. Now, in terms of the more broad issue, one of the top terms of reference in this assessment was to look at the retrospective pattern. And previous reports of this meeting, as Jim has relayed to you, earlier meetings of the council, the retrospective patterns can arise through at least three sources of change. One is missing landings, missing catch. That is, either you're not fully accounting for discards and not estimating those, so that changes your scale. The other one is that the survey catchability can change, that you're not catching them in the same proportions. Those changes can occur sometimes if the stock is moving somewhere else, if they're not available to the gear and so forth. And then the final one is natural mortality rates. So it's basically a situation where you're losing or something is changing in terms of an underlying process. And if you're not accounting for those losses in some way, then you can have some serious consequences for the assessment. And a lot of smart people all around the world have been looking at this because this is one of the major challenges in fishery science right now in terms of the relevance of information. So if the estimates are too high or subject to a measure of bias, it's extremely disconcerting. It's an extremely important problem. There are several international groups that are trying to address it as well. The way we have handled it in this assessment, and this is again subject to the final model formulations, which will be set up in August, is to alias the change. That is to look at it in aggregate change. By splitting the time series of the survey values to a period from 1994 onward. We've been doing some additional work in terms of modeling analysis, and everything we've done across all the species, this is post-GARM stuff and not not subject to peer review, but stuff that we've been doing internally, is suggesting that that whatever changes occurred in terms of our ability to measure scale, that is the magnitude of the resource, that is the total aggregate of landings and discards and natural mortality rates, that process changed about 1994. So we're seeing significant and changes there. And that information is will be incorporated into these final model formulations, which, you know, will in effect sort of alias that mixture of changes in terms of a change in catchability. It will have to go a fair amount of there'll be a lot of groundwork to lay to sort of explain how that is going on, but the consequence we've seen also is that those changes do seem to take into account or handle the retrospective pattern very well. So this the council has some experience with this process already in the so-called major change model used for Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. That same principle seems to work for a number of other stocks, so that will be the subject of the presentation this September at the council, and then certainly those inclined to come in August and spend a nice steamy week in a small room in Woods Hole will be available. So, I'm sorry to take so long on that, but I think it's a kind of a central topic that I just want to give a little bit of background on it. So, thanks.
Do you have air conditioning?
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
We want it to end early. We turn it off.
I imagine that get people moving. The second question I have is on these ones that have a new model. Obviously, the peer review is saying that the new model is the improved model, or they wouldn't have pushed it forward. But if they run the old, whether it's an index or surplus production, or even if it's a VPA, have they run the old model to see, you know, get some kind of comparison? I'm kind of looking for something on the scale of the changes here, trying to see whether I buy into them or not, type thing, and what kind of proof you got that, you know, these were the right numbers.
Yeah, the comparison across models is an important component there, and so the so-called building the bridge between the old and the new is also an important part of these determinations, and I think the final report will give some of that, but perhaps not satisfy the intensity you have in terms of making those comparisons. We will incorporate that into the final benchmark assessment in August, and this is under discussion, but it'll we're going to try and make it a really lean document, so it's going to be about 300 pages that will summarize the information, you know, provide the critical information for the stock assessments. But in order to get into some of the details that you're related to, you know, that you're interested in, that there'll be a set of appendices. So rather than put a 1,500-page document in front of everybody, we'll try to keep it so that there'll be a kind of a stylized format so that you can page back and forth and get the salient features. So hopefully we won't completely overwhelm. But again, these are 19 simultaneous benchmarks. So that's sort of the nature of the current standards in terms of trying to justify all the changes and decisions that are made. So thanks, Dave.
Sally?
I'm not quite sure where to start with this, and I don't quite have a sense of how people are receiving this, but my jaw kind of hit the table when the numbers started going up. And while I appreciate all the caveats, and we certainly should consider the caveats that were given at the beginning of the presentation. I think we also need to consider that we're not just looking at one stock that's very different from what was expected, like what happened in 2005 with yellowtail flounder, but most, if not all, flounders are trending in a certain direction. So I hope that we take the time today and this afternoon to consider what a more appropriate course would be in response to what we've heard, understanding that, you know, this has not been peer reviewed. This is not these aren't final numbers from the Science Center, but I think it would be irresponsible for us not to be listening to this. And I appreciate that we've had the chance to look at these numbers relatively sooner rather than later. I do have a question, and maybe you kind of answered this with respect to winter flounder, which was one of the Georges Bank winter flounder, which was one of the stocks where a new model is being used. And I was just wondering if you can explain in that case how it is that the that FMSY is not significantly higher as it was in the case for a number of the other stocks. I guess I was surprised with BMSY being so low that that FMSY would have been, you would be estimating that to be higher. So maybe if you can explain how that was not the case for winter flounder. That's one specific question that I have.
Yeah, that's slide 36. The change there was the previous model was using it was a surplus production model. The fishing mortality rate on that in a surplus production model is a biomass weighted average applied to the entire pool of the stock. In the case for the VPA model, it's incorporating. The take-home message is that it's a very rough kind of estimator of fishing mortality rate across an undifferentiated pool of ages and both sexes. When you go to the VPA, you're accounting for the between year dynamics of cohorts, so you're following cohorts over time, and in addition, incorporating quite a bit more information about their life history in terms of age-specific maturation, age-specific size at age, and so forth. So the currency is not completely comparable across the two. So I don't think it's particularly a large difference for Georges Bank winter flounder. It has a similar pattern to what we were talking about for Gulf of Maine winter flounder, where that the change was downward, and probably we probably have the first digit right. In terms of magnitude, the second and third digits to the right of the decimal point are certainly, softer numbers, certainly. So, but they are all conditional on estimates of natural mortality. Everything that is done in terms of estimating those rates are based on natural mortality rates of that are incorporated in the model. Generally, that's on the order of 0.2. So did I answer your question, or is that okay? Thanks, Sally.
And I had one more question, and it has to do with the Canadians. So for the stocks that are currently managed under the resource sharing understanding, I know there was at least one Canadian on this panel, but, you know, obviously once these numbers become more finalized, then the potential agreement or disparity between what the U.S. and the Canadians are determining in stock assessments becomes more difficult in the decision-making venue. So can you just talk about how you've been working with the Canadians on those shared stocks right now, aside from having them serve on this panel?
Sure. The three major shared stocks are haddock, cod, and yellowtail. And the assessment process through the track will be occurring in June, right after the GARM, or after the SARC, excuse me. So that's the week of June 23rd that assessment will be taking place. In that context, they use a Eastern Georges Bank stock assessment. They restrict it. They assume the fish are at the Hague line, and so it's a smaller subset area there for cod and haddock. The yellowtail assessment and the joint meeting will take place the week after the GARM in August. So there will be that coordination process will take place there. Also, you know, we as colleagues with Canadians, we have been sort of keeping up on. They're well aware of where this process is going, and also they send the A team down for our GARM meetings. You know, so they keep up to where we are on it. We had Lou Van Eckhout was on the data meeting as well, and we had Stephen Smith from DFO Canada was also there. So you know, we've had them participate in a variety of ways. So thanks.
Tom, did you have some questions?
Not a question so much as an observation, and it actually follows in pretty well with what Sally just said. You know, in addition to the changes in Whitehake and some of the others that were noticed, I'd point out that, you know, you see some very different potentially versions of stock status between GARM 2 and this one that, you know, you really can't explain by what went on in fishing activity. It seems to be related to the choice of assessment model more than anything else. For example, which flounder back under GARM 2, the spawning stock biomass was estimated to be over 20,000 metric tons, and the stock was expected to be rebuilt very shortly. That was somewhere on the order of 75% of SSBMSY. Now, in this assessment, it looks like in 2006, the stock was borderline overfished. Gulf of Maine haddock, kind of the other direction. We thought it was overfished in the last assessment. Trawl Survey Index, mind you, an index-based assessment, the Trawl Survey Index had been declining for that stock for the last couple of years. And now it appears that in 2006, the stock is above SSBMSY. So, you know, these are major shifts. If you look at the two windowpane flounders, they flip-flopped. You know, we used to think southern was overfished and northern was not, and now it appears that our perception is the opposite. I don't know how the management system reacts. You know, I don't intend this to be critical of the assessment scientists, because I've been down to the GARM meetings, and I know they've done a ton of work on this stuff. But, you know, I don't know how the management system can react to changes like this in relatively short time periods, the reality is. The other thing is that following up on the Sally's comment, I just point out that this Georges Bank cod estimate for 2006 isn't really consistent with the track estimate for 2006, and so that will have to be reconciled at the next track. I mean, this Georges Bank cod SSB estimate for 2006, I think, is a little bit less than what the track said was on Eastern Georges, or similar numbers anyway, you know. And then the last point relates to this survey splitting issue, and Paul pointed out that the council's kind of familiar with survey splitting based on the major change model for Georges Bank yellowtail. I would hope that when they consider extending the survey splitting, they would look at how well that assessment has performed in recent years, or as I would characterize it, how well that assessment has not performed in matching up predicted catches with realized Fs. If you look at the major change assessment model used at the track, and when you look at our U.S. and Canadian catches of yellowtail flounder, we've generally, I think in recent years, even been always under the target, always under the TAC that was set, which was expected to realize our FMSY or F reference value. And the reality is the next year we do the assessment and we find out the F is three times higher than FMSY. Now that's happened two or three years in a row with a major change model, which gives me some question whether splitting the survey time series, while it makes the assessment look better and not have a retrospective pattern, whether it's really doing a better job of getting us closer to what reality is for the stock. And I would hope that you guys would look at that as well, as not just the analytic things, but how well this process has performed in the case of Georges Bank Yellowtail.
I currently have David Pierce, David Simpson, and I guess Dave Gaither wants to be on there. They put the three Daves right next to each other.
Yeah, well, Tom just made a couple of my points, and that is the change in the assessment models apparently is having some profound impact on the assessment results. So I look forward to the GARM for further discussions regarding those changes in models and what it all means. In addition, the survey splitting, as Tom just highlighted, in talking with my staff, I'm also struggling to understand the extent to which survey splitting actually is more of a, well, it's, what exactly does it mean? And is it a valid thing to do? Is it really providing us with a means to identify what's out there as opposed to a way to fix a model? My question, however, is with regard to ecosystem considerations and the productivity of the ecosystem, that, of course, is extremely important for us to consider as time goes on, especially in light of some of the points you made earlier in your presentation. That is, fisheries managers, we are going to have to account for the lack of productivity, and I think that means that we're likely going to be obliged to be precautionary in our approach and set our TACs much lower than we would like to have them be to account for less productivity or changes in productivity of the system. Energy budgets for the ecological system, that was one approach that was used that you mentioned, Paul. So my question is, was there any discussion about whether the budget for the entire system has changed, or has the energy within the system been sequestered in different parts? In other words, the old pelagic and elasmobranch question, has the energy within the system, the productivity within the system, actually been maintained, but now the energy is in elasmobranchs and pelagics as opposed to in the groundfish?
Yes, I can answer the last question first, and I would like to address the two earlier points you made as well. But the changes in productivity were examined. One of the consequences of change was there were major changes in zooplankton productivity over the last 15 years. Those consequences sort of rippled through in terms of what maybe the differences in average growth rates. The consequences of the elasmobranch-teleost balance there were incorporated into the mixture as well as the pelagics. So all of the results that I summarized there at the end were conditioned on those values. I have the results. There is, in the final report, there will be a comparative table that has the mixture of biomass estimates. Now, excuse me for a second here. Okay, there are going to be four lines, or two lines, excuse me, which address the sort of the MSY estimates for pelagics and elasmobranchs and so forth. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. We can summarize it in the or offline or as formal correspondence. In terms of the draft results,
simply stated, have groundfish suffered as a consequence of the high abundance of herring and mackerel and the skates and the dogfish?
I guess suffering is a relative term. I don't know. And perhaps Bill or someone else more intimately related or familiar with those assessments could add something to that debate there. But we can respond. But I just want to take one moment to address two of the issues that have come up in terms of sort of the differences that we're seeing are driven by models. They're in part driven by models, but in fact we have gone through a great deal of effort to update the data associated with this, and in particular trying to account for the discarding in a pretty comprehensive fashion to try to get comparable and comprehensive estimates across stocks so that we're doing it. So that is one major change in terms of those things, and then as well trying to properly characterize the changes we're seeing in average size of the animals and making sure that everything's kind of copacetic. So it's not just the assessment models that are driving these different results. The other one and is related is to the concept of the survey splitting kind of thing. As I said, it's an alias for several factors acting simultaneously. We could equally well cast these changes in terms of what we think or what the consequences would have been for increased catch, that is, unobserved catch, discards, mortality, and so forth, or changing M as it would be the other way of sort of letting it pop out from the other end as a combined factor. But that has not been as desirable. Well, it's less tenable. And in fact, we're following the guidance that Doug Butterworth and others have really emphasized, is that your models should be consistent with the most recent data, in that you want to make sure that when you have disparities occurring, that they're not occurring in your most recent estimates, and that's kind of a general premise around the world. And to that point, you know, we have differences in that are in terms of numbers declining in surveys. It's not just our surveys where they're declining. It's in the Massachusetts surveys. It's in the Canadian DFO surveys. It's in the New Hampshire Maine trawl survey and so forth. All of these things are showing consistent signals in the flatfish arena. So they are dropping quite extensively. So thanks.
I have Dave Simpson and Dave Gaethel.
Okay, thanks. I had a question about winter flounder in particular and wonder if it has broader application to flatfish. But we've noticed in our surveys in Connecticut in the last several years that the ratios of age zero indices to ones in the subsequent year, ones to twos in the subsequent year, and so forth, are highly suggestive of an increase in natural mortality. And I'm wondering to what extent you've examined the potential change in natural mortality in winter flounder and some of these other flatfish in general, and of course the implications for the stock assessment, the reference points, retrospective patterns that are really problematic with this species.
Yeah, those are excellent points, and you know, we have seen the changes. The yellowtail have been looked at more intensively than others. In the SARC, the assessment for fluke coming up in June looked at it fairly extensively in terms of the changes in natural mortality rates. Not only may there be temporal changes across years, but we're also evidence of sex-specific changes as well. So there's no question that they could be underlying some of these changes, but the evidence and sort of the ability to deal with them explicitly is pretty tough right now. So.
Yeah, I guess I just wonder what it takes sometimes to push, forgive me, but push the center off of 0.20 for M. And I know it took quite a battle and a lengthy discussion on summer flounder, and I've been on that committee since 1993, and it apparently changed this year. And it was just really apparent long-term that males don't survive as long as females, and so clearly there's that higher M that's evident. It's really problematic with fluke because for the recreational fishery, they're fishing exclusively now on female fish because males don't grow to 20 inches in length typically. But I think I just wonder what needs to happen in terms of these, that aspect, the long term, there's a difference in survival of males and females and flatfishes. And in particular with winter flounder and maybe other stocks, where there's an indication of a recent change or an increase in natural mortality, and moving away from that question mark that transforms into a 0.2 for your calculation of M to something that's maybe more realistic. I don't mean to be sarcastic about it, but I know there's a lot of inertia to stay at 0.2, and I just wonder how to deal with that.
I think Jim wants to make an intervention, and I'll respond here. So.
Thanks. I think everyone recognizes that it's a tremendous amount of work to do 19 benchmark assessments all at once. So people are working as hard as they can, but the points you raised about going into greater detail are valid for certain species. And what we're doing after the GARM... for those of us that are still on our feet, the plan is to have the SARC schedule put certain species that are GARM species, schedule them on the SARC for individual assessments so that they'll get a lot more attention. So that's our long-range plan.
Okay. I have Nancy first.
Yeah, thanks, Rip. Sorry, I don't want to beat this, to whatever, but I think it's a good point. And clearly we are trying to do what we can relative to some of these parameter estimates that over time become almost like conventional wisdom. I mean, it certainly is a valid question, and we are able to, and I think Jim's point is that we are able, when we can do a single species or fewer species, we can look at those kinds of questions, and we are looking at those, and particularly natural mortality as it relates to the single species. But in the context of doing, as Jim indicated, 19 benchmark assessments, it's very difficult. But it's a question that clearly has been raised through this entire process, and what it requires, obviously, is information. And so in the case of other stocks where we have been able to look and evaluate natural mortality, it is because that information is there. The empirical evidence is there. And in this particular case, again, because of the situation in terms of dealing with the 19 stocks, not having that empirical information then requires us, obviously, to use best available, and it is 0.2.
I have Dave Gaethel, then Jim Rule, then we will have been over 2 hours into this. We will take a break and without major objection move into the monitoring topic. Dave.
Okay, I'll be brief. My questions are on the three yellowtail stocks. It's hard to tell from these scale charts. Has there been any changes in the stock boundaries? I know statistical blocks 98 and 99 have been problematic for yellowtail in assigning the catch to the three stalks. You know, which passport am I carrying today?
The short answer is no change in the stock boundaries.
Okay, so the stock boundaries remain the same. The other question I have, and I mean, this is the one that just leaps off the page at me constantly with Cape Cod Gulf of Maine yellowtail. They have these F rates of 0.8, 0.9, 1.2. They've been that way for 30 years, and yet we seem to catch the same amount. I mean, they're just there. You know, they don't, I mean, how can you have F rates that high and have any fish left after 30 years? It almost seems to defy common sense, unless something else is happening that's not being accounted for here.
I think it's, well, one, it's a testimony to the productivity of the ecosystem that we harvest from, that it continues to respond, that we, you know, in that way. It's similar to, you know, for many years that these fisheries were certainly recruitment-based fisheries, that, you know, you had a short lifespan after you entered the population. Oftentimes these fish by shifting their age at reproduction, you know, you're selecting for animals that reproduce earlier and so forth. But it's an important question. It's one that we wrestle with, but, you know, ultimately you see the consequence that many of these stocks do collapse after being fished at these excessively high rates, you know. And I mean, it used to be 20,000 tons used to be taken out of southern New England yellowtail. The ocean pout fishery was a 30,000 ton fishery in the 50s. So, you know, once they're gone, they take a long time to come back. I guess the long-term persistence issue is one, well, Mother Nature is more complicated than we are,
Captain Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First off, Paul, if there's anybody from the Science Center that can present this kind of information without giving everybody heart failure, it's you. And I really appreciate the job you did. You're extremely capable of dealing with issues like that. But I've got a question, and it'll probably come after this comment. But I don't have the answer, and maybe you do right off the top of your head, but my understanding of the summer flounder fishery, the fluke fishery, is there is no shortage of the larger fish. I'm not so sure that this reduced maturity is taking place as much in the summer flounder fishery as all your others. The industry has been discarding the largest fish simply because of market conditions. You know, if you're going to get 25 or 30 or 40 cents a pound less for the real big fish, you throw them overboard, especially if they're the strongest ones that make the most survival. So I don't believe we have that problem. I believe part of the problem we have with summer flounder is the fact that we're going to be targeting through one of the management regimes the larger fish, and it's 17 and a half inches. Everything over 17 and a half inches is a female. Simple as that. That can be supported scientifically. So I guess what I'm looking at here now from, let's call it anecdotal, I'm not even going to go to empirical. The summer flounders have shifted their range well over 200 miles, and it's to the north and east. The mackerel, for all practical purposes in the United States, the fisheries collapsed. Those fish exist. The stock is still there, but the fish have migrated to the eastern portion of Canada, southeast of Labrador, where they haven't been since the turn of the century. The Canadian assessment does not, in fact, capture that, not in a real comfortable manner. I think this is a cycle. I think fisheries are changing and the fish are adapting, but I'm very concerned with this trend for smaller size, delayed mortality at age, decreased survival of recruitments. I'm convinced in my mind that we're asking the ocean to do something it cannot do. I think we've reached maximum sustainable yields for the ocean to support what we're trying to do, maximize all species at the same time. We've argued before, it has never been in history, it will never be accomplished. If our targets are so high that we're going to fail on every species because the ocean can't support it, we need to rethink everything we're doing, everything. So it's been brought up here at this table, rethink the way we're doing the management, rethink the way we're looking at different populations. It absolutely has to happen, but it may have to happen by reducing unachievable goals. And you know, this ecosystem thing keeps coming up and coming up, and I know what an ecosystem is. I know what I think an ecosystem is, and I know it has the ability to change, and I know fish will adapt to it way the hell before we do. We'll figure it out after a while and find out what they've done and how they've done it, and then you have a problem. But I honestly believe it's everybody should recognize where we're trying to go, we can't get there. And what cost is it going to be to this country's fishing industry to try to achieve something that can't happen? So if there's a question embedded in this, sir, it's, and I also would like to say that I do believe that the science, I appreciate your comments about other surveys supporting some of your issues, because I do believe that the Science Center's existing survey has very significant problems with flatfish, because I think there's a major inconsistency with bottom contact with that gear that, in my mind, discredits the consistency of the entire survey. But if you're saying that other surveys are supporting that, then that I do feel better about that. I'm not saying it's, I agree. I just do feel better. But honest to God, Paul, I don't know if you're in a position to do it or not, but are we to a point where the indications of these fish, you know, having to be spawning smaller, we know what that results in, less productivity. Simple as that. It's stated here. What is it going to take? I mean, I don't know what the question even is anymore, but am I anywhere near on target with this in your mind? Just yours alone would be really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touch on some really important points, and number one, I think that, you know, that trying to get a handle on system productivity is sort of first and foremost. Now, one measure that we can take as sort of the tactical step in terms of these assessments is to look at the average weights, because that represents an integration of all the environmental effects that have occurred since that animal was born. How much food did it get? What kind of thermal regime was it experiencing? What food quality might have been available to it over time? So that's a very important aspect of the measure of ecosystem change. If you put a thermometer out there that was a 5-year thermometer, you'd probably, you know, you could do the same thing by looking at the change in average growth rate or average size of a 5-year-old fish. So it is in part addressing sort of those broad scale issues of ecosystem change. That being said, the science that can totally address all of those measures in terms of the simultaneous attainment of target fishing mortality rates and so forth is still developing rapidly. A lot of major advances are being made, but as Michael Graham addressed the United Nations in 1950, he said, the world goes on while the specialists put their minds in order. And Michael Graham was the supervisor of Beaverton and Holt back in the day, but this was right after the war. So, but basically, you know, the idea is that it has to be approached on two different levels. One is the short-term tactical aspects of making decisions with incomplete information and choosing the least worst of untenable options, which I guess is the what we do as fisheries scientists and fisheries managers. And then the other one is to try to get the long-term, deeper understanding of the system behavior and performance. So, thanks, Jim.
Just a quick follow-up. Neglected to state that with the summer flounders moving 200 miles up the coast, a lot of species you're talking about here, the line is there. When they move that kind of a distance, if that's what it takes for them to be in a comfortable environment, they're now in Canadian waters. I think that's pretty evident with haddock. And I'm not saying that the Canadians are not doing a fairly good job of trying to do the assessments, but I think a lot of their assessments fall short of ours in some species. So, this shift in species is something that really needs to be looked at a little bit harder. The resource that's available to us certainly may be experiencing all of this, but is it in fact global as far as the relationship with Canada? And are they telling us 100% of the truth when they go forward with this? Because I know Canada has a tendency to protect its fishermen at some time, and I'm not 100% comfortable with the information coming back. But I do appreciate your presentation and your answers. Thank you.
I can't comment on your last point about Canada, but I would note that the changes that occur in species distribution have been observed, not just recently, but of course, one that comes to mind immediately is in 1982, when the ilex were in inshore Newfoundland, much like 78. That was the year of the ilex. So thanks.
Paul, thank you very much for the presentation. I don't think we shot the messenger too badly. And thank you to all of the people who have put in the time and effort on this assessment. We'll have a 10-minute break. Vito? We'll do it after the break. I don't think he's going to run away.
I never know what one of the science people are going to do from time to time.
There were conversations going on there. If you do want to carry on a conversation in the back of the room, please step outside so that the other people can hear what is going on. We are going to start off the comment period. We have a representative from Senator Snow's office who would like to read something into the record. Mike, if you would come up and read that. Yes, please.
Thank you very much to the members of the council for the opportunity to address you this morning. I do have a statement to read on behalf of Senator Snow regarding this issue. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to address the council today on this matter so critical to an industry that has sustained generations of Mainers and New Englanders for centuries. I find it a terrible irony that this gathering is in Portland, just a few blocks from the Portland Fish Exchange, which has seen the number of vessels supplying its auctions decline by over 50% and the volume of fish drop by over 60% since the year 2000, to discuss further slashing cuts to days at sea, which, if adopted, would certainly spell an end to the groundfish industry in Maine and quite likely sound the death knell for the fishery throughout New England. As chair and now ranking member of the Senate subcommittee with jurisdiction over our fisheries, for over a decade I have helped this industry fight desperately for its life in the face of increasingly stringent regulations. Through it all, the fishermen have held out hope that the reduction in fishing effort that they have taken would allow fish stocks to rebound and their vocation to return to viability. At the very least, we hoped these sacrifices would be acknowledged by the agency as it developed additional measures to return fish populations to sustainable levels. But judging by the options now before us, that does not appear to be the case. To the contrary, today we stand at the edge of a precipice, the likes of which we have never faced. The proposals being considered by the council would destroy the hope to which fishermen have clung while their life's work has been whittled away. These proposals would whittle it away to nothing. Worse yet, the National Marine Fisheries Service demands that the council effectively shut down the fishery without having given it a fair trial. Under the regulations established by Amendment 13, the Council is directed to develop a mid-course adjustment to the Fishery Management Plan for 2009. The regulations further stipulate, in no uncertain terms, that this adjustment must be based on the results of a scientific, peer-reviewed 2008 benchmark assessment of the status of each groundfish stock. NIMS has preliminary data from that assessment, also known as the GARM, but the full report is not expected to be completed until August. By adhering to one aspect of its regulations, the 2009 deadline for adjustment, while ignoring another, the requirement to base that adjustment on the GARM, NIMS is applying an unacceptable double standard and violating the balance of conservation and management required under the national standards of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. In addition to this misrepresentation of its own regulations, it will be illegal for NIMS to require these actions to be finalized at the council meeting in October as presently scheduled. The law requires that whenever a council bases regulations on new information, it must also allow the public an opportunity to respond to that data, and NIMS must have sufficient time to give comparable consideration to the public's information. A GARM released in August will not be formally presented until the same October meeting, at which the council will make its final decision. I fail to comprehend how this time frame meets the requirements clearly laid out in the law. In recent months, it has also become clear to me that NIMS regional office is approaching its responsibilities with a skewed perspective. The law requires regulations to achieve the two-pronged goal of protecting our fish stocks and our fishing communities. While these proposals may point us in the direction of the former, they completely preclude and discount the latter. Maine's groundfish fleet currently supports less than half the vessels it had in 1994, and shoreside jobs in fish processing and wholesaling in the state have fallen by over 40% in that same time period. Still, everyone in this room recognizes the need to manage our fisheries sustainably. We all recognize there are fewer fish in the sea now than there were in decades past, and no one is asking for a return to unfettered fishing practices. But if our vision of future rebuilt fish stocks does not include a healthy fishing industry as mandated, then what are we managing for? In a letter to Jim Balsiger, the acting director of NIMS, I and my Senate colleagues from Maine and Massachusetts insisted that any decision on these proposals be delayed. Today I take that request one step further. Simply put, delay will not suffice. At no time will any of the options we have before us today be acceptable to me or to the fishing industry. Not today, not on May 1st, 2009, not on November 1st, 2009. Instead, I pledge to work with the agency and the fishing community to ensure that we develop sensible, legal regulations to manage this industry sustainably, now and into the future, and to achieve a mutually acceptable outcome. I simply will not stand idly by as NIMS mismanages one of our nation's most historic fisheries to the point of annihilation. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take some. Vito, you're first on the list. I would request that when coming up or asking a question, that the question focus on the presentation, not the greater implications of the information that we got today.
I got my. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Vito J. Calamo. I'm the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Fishery Recovery Commission out of Massachusetts. Mr. Chairman, I'll try to stick to what you asked for, but I've got my notes and I'll do the best I can. I've even tightened my belt so I wouldn't be so windy. One person, for 3 days I've been here, and one person said that when I speak it sounds like homilies. The other says a person from North Carolina, a friend of mine, says I sound like a Baptist minister. Well, 30 years of management, 400 years of fishing from the Port of Gloucester. I don't know what I sound like, but I guess I'm kind of saddened. Mr. Chairman, I just heard from Senator Snow's office, and that wasn't part of what I've written, but I applaud Senator Snow. I applaud Senator Kennedy, Kerry, Bonnie Frank, our congressman, and others that have seen that the importance of the fishing industry to our eastern seaboard. I listened to Dr. Paul Rago, as I have for years, and I have a lot of respect for the gentleman. He brings us sad news, as he has done from time to time, whether it be flounders or dogfish, and he is just the messenger, and I'm not here to punish the messenger. In one of his slides, he says that the halibut in 1880s or 1890s in Boston, the slide was of my area, Massachusetts, who I represent, he said the horses left the barn. I think it was many years ago when the Commonwealth of Massachusetts spoke very loudly with other states about the Hague Line. For 12 years, we asked to have some kind of a Hague line, some kind of a 200-mile limit. It was the fishing industry that cried out at that time. It was not management. It was not the government. It was us petitioning the government that we needed restrictions. We endorsed the New England Fisheries Management Council. We endorsed the Mid-Atlantic Council. We endorsed all management to help save our fisheries. Too little, too late, maybe. Or it wasn't done fast enough, maybe. Or they didn't listen to fishermen. And I was one fisherman for 30 years that have gone to the pulpit either here or there and have spoken. The fishing industry is what developed the East Coast of New England. There was no other industry. 400 years have passed, and all our management, and I say all our management, not your management, our management hasn't done a thing, really, for the fishing stocks. It has done something. We now have a trivial fishing industry in the Port of Boston. Trivial, a small, few vessels left in once the proud point of Provincetown. And the oldest fishing port in the United States is down to a handful of vessels, which is my port of Gloucester, Massachusetts. It's a saddened day to listen to Dr. Ragel. Paul, I was stunned to hear the news because I guess I didn't get the news prior to you giving your presentation. We still have no balance. We have restrictions, more restrictions, more restrictions, and there's no balance for the fishing industry. I think that my friend Jimmy Rule and I have said the same thing at many meetings, and I'm glad he said it again. Seems to be not the fishing industry, but other things. Environmental conditions, dams, DDT or other pesticides in the ocean, the abundance of predators. We all want to leave enough fish in the ocean for predators. Well, they're doing a hell of a good job. There's more seals than I've ever seen in my 64 years of living on the ocean or by the ocean. There's more birds of prey, which is good. I enjoy watching whales and seals and everything else, but we need to think about the communities and the economics during these times that we're going through. This is the worst time I've ever seen in my 64 years of living. We're heading into a disastrous area. If we don't do something, and I don't know what to do. I really don't know. I used to have ideas. I've made many presentations how to try to stop the bleeding, but I don't have the ideas. I'm very proud today to listen to the managers, especially the directors from different states, to make the comments they made after Dr. Ragel's presentation. I'm very proud. I heard some great comments, but that doesn't cure it. We are hanging on by a fin and a tail. I don't know what to say. I'm beside myself. But I appreciate an opportunity to speak. And listening again to people like Senator Snow speak today here through a staff person is encouraging that they are listening. To see the letter that was written and all signed on to slow down the process a little, to see if we can save our fishing communities, is encouraging. And again, I'll be redundant and I will end shortly. You have given me enough time to listen to the comments today by the New England Fisheries Management Council. People sitting at the table is also encouraging. And the last thing I'll say, Mr. Chairman, since I've been mostly positive on comments, is that the National Marine Fisheries Service needs to make time. I heard we don't have enough time. This is what you do. You need to make time for the people. You need to make time for the people that established this fishing industry. You need to make time to save the economics up and down the coast, not only for today, but for tomorrow as well. I thank you very much for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Glenn?
I'm afraid I am going to limit myself to the presentation by Paul Rego. By the way, I do appreciate that very much, that we've had a snapshot of 2006. I would, however, stress to everybody that one of the reasons we're experiencing this challenging time frame and schedule for Amendment 16 and as it relates to the GARM was a deliberate decision to do that so that we would have the benefit of 2007 fishing data. That was the whole point. And to be able to reflect what are hopefully significant mortality reductions achieved as a result of some of the measures in Framework 42, such as the 2-to-1 differential counting areas, trip limits, et cetera. So, you know, and we've also, here in the industry, for example, we hear that landings of Georges Bank winter flounder have been reduced by about 70% from 2006 to 2007. And so we expect to see some significant changes. And so while we had a snapshot presented to us by the PDT based on what I'm sure they would admit was the best they could do with whatever information was available, they had to put something on paper to analyze for the purposes of satisfying NEPA. These 2006 numbers certainly changed the picture for a number of those alternatives or options that were presented by the PDT, and I think that 2007 may very likely change some other stocks, the picture of those stocks. I'm not trying to create a rosy picture that, you know, the writing's on the wall, we have some problems there. But again, I hope we will focus on what was the whole point, which is to get the benefit of the 2007 data, and that will come out in as timely a fashion as possible. One of the points that Paul made early on in his presentation was that some changes or revisions in the picture for White Hake had some particularly profound, perhaps the most profound, implications relative to the projections that had been presented by the PDT to the Groundfish Committee in those three options, and in particular the 70% days at sea cut alternative. And I wanted to ask if Paul could elaborate on that a little bit, because as we see the current and revised BMSYs are changed tremendously, and I'm not sure why the FMSY went down in that respect, but in any case, I believe we're, at least in 2006, overfishing is not occurring, and I presume that has a great deal of implication for the recommendation that had come out of the PDT for a 70% cut that was driven by the White Hake scenario. So I think I was just hoping that somebody on the council would pick up on that and ask you to elaborate it. So if you would, Paul.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn. The White Hake, of course, is probably the central assessment or preliminary results being presented here in terms of not only a complete revision of the model approach that was used to assess this resource. It also had a fair amount of input from Doug Butterworth. There was an alternative model that he prepared, which was similar conceptually to that which was ultimately adopted by the panel, and will be summarized in the report. As I mentioned, the change in scale, that is the magnitude of the biomass at MSY changes, is driven by a number of factors, but the primary one is that it now incorporates the stock size for animals greater than, or for fish greater than 60 centimeters. It includes all size ranges, whereas in the past it was only the 60 centimeter and up individuals. We probably spent more time on White Hake. I guess that came in second after Gulf of Maine cod. But in terms of the total time that was available for the assessment, we spent a great deal of time on the White Hake. And there were a number of scenarios which it looked at a whole range of what the starting conditions were, you know, whether it was at 25% of it's a virgin stock size or 50% or whatever. The conclusions of the panel and the discussions at the meeting suggested that, you know, these numbers in terms of the stock biomasses, you know, are probably fairly robust. I guess I should eliminate some of the qualifiers there. It was fairly robust. They did additionally suggest some more runs prior to the meeting and a greater fleshing out of sort of the model formulation. But I think in general the observation that the fishing mortality is low relative to the target is probably going to be in the ballpark. Now, again, the conditions under which the charge the PDT had for creating management scenarios was based on forecast on a model that's no longer being used, and those forecasts were made in 2001, you know, as part of the first GARM. So so.
Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
Is there anybody else in the audience who has a question of Dr. Rago concerning the presentation? Seeing none, back to the council. Anything, Jim? One.
I have a couple questions. Dr. Rago, I sat in on the GARM for a couple days, and most of the language is above
You're a trooper.
Most of the language is above my pay grade. But I did pick up on a couple of items, and I think Mr. Simpson was touching on that. And, you know, I heard a debate, I think, going on that you were using M2 for Gulf of Maine cod, and that there are several countries or several areas that may use 0.3 or 0.35. My question is, where did you settle, or has that been settled? Because I wasn't clear whether that ended up being settled.
We used 0.2 as the basis.
Okay. And I have another follow-up question of Dr. Thompson. You said that, you know, you're using 0.2, you're doing 18, 19 stocks, and that you don't have time to do an assessment on, a true assessment on what natural mortality rates you should use. So my question to you is, how much time would it take to do a full in-depth study by stock on the true natural mortality that's going on in the fisheries today?
Paul, Jim, I mean, since they're the modelers and know what it is in terms of the data quality that's required, I can tell you that, for example, for summer flounder, the previous benchmark assessment was completed about 3 or 4 years ago, and we just completed one recently, which took a very hard look at summer flounder. And so to really get in-depth information and evaluate natural mortality in terms of developing, hopefully, an empirically based estimate would probably take, I would think, for that data to be available, probably 2 years.
Thank you. Dave, that's that last question, and we are definitely moving on after that.
Okay. The question basically is, I've had a chance to kind of go through these numbers a little more. Paul, can you tell us which ones of these stocks cannot be rebuilt in the time remaining in the rebuilding plan? Even if we shut the fishery down, I think there's at least 3 or 4 of them, but there may be more.
No, I can't. The well, probably halibut for sure. no, the I think the estimates of the F rebuild have not been computed for that, and you know the basis, I would guess, under which a not being able to rebuild would be on the hypothetical F equals zero sort of basis. That could be one scenario that would be considered by the council and the PDT. The other aspect, which you know, ties back into our discussions yesterday on bycatch, of course, is that you have a mix of species that are being taken, and the ability to control the mortality on one versus the other is highly problematic without either the various gear technology factors and so forth. So the very short answer is no, I can't do it. But you know that will be the factor at the GARM.
So we'll get that information in August then, or do you know when we'll know those numbers?
The report is to be released September 2nd or 3rd or something like that. So that data will be available at that point. If you come to the GARM, you can probably get an early heads up on what the likely conclusions are. But in terms of the preparation of the report, getting all the pieces together and getting that lean 300-page report out, it's going to probably take a few weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you again, Paul. Appreciate that. We're going to take, a minute or so to get switched over to our next.